I mentioned when we were commencing the journey from the children of Israel, as it's accounted from chapter number 10, we learned that there were a number of rebellions. There was a rebellion, first of all, against God's provision, and that is when the manna was the subject of the loathing of the children of Israel. And then there was a rebellion against God's prophet, as there was that matter which was raised by Miriam and Aaron regarding Moses. And then there was the rebellion against God's promise, or you might desire to call that the rebellion against God's purpose. And then there was now, in chapter number 16, the rebellion against God's priests. And that is exactly the issue in chapter number 16. Now, I want you to observe, please, that most who date the Bible put this as about 19 years after the events of the previous chapter. No matter how we look at it, it is the only event recorded of the 38 years in the wilderness before the children of Israel returned to Kadesh Barnea and then commenced the journey again to Canaan. This, in the book of Numbers, is the only historical event of anything that took place between the refusal to take the land and all that was involved in that and the journey when it commenced back to Canaan. I think it's most remarkable, and I say again, that there were 38 years where there was nothing of value that was marked by God. Now, that is a very solemn thing. The possibility of living almost 40 years with nothing that was of value, as it were. And the sad matter is that the only lesson that can be taught from these 38 years is the lesson of the folly of disobedience and the folly of rebellion. My brethren and sisters, it ill behoves us to look in this as a light thing. This rebellion was momentous. We will see the problem was great. But there is a personal lesson for us. And I wonder if it is just this, that the only lesson that can be taken from our lives is the lessons that go with failure. 38 years of failure, 38 years of being in the wilderness, 38 years of no progress for God. I wonder if we just let that sink into our minds. 38 years of no progress for God. If I was to count that back from today, I think that would take me back to 1969. From 1969 right through here to 2007, and no progress in the things of God, and nothing that marked them but this remarkable incident, which was one of gross failure and gross presumption. I tell you, it is a salutary lesson to me and a salutary lesson to you that there can be years that are empty of anything for God. And there can be years that from our life there is nothing joy that ascends to heaven. And so this is the sad backdrop to the rebellion of Korah. I want you to notice, please, that in the book of Jude, we learn that it was indeed the gainsaying of Korah. And that expression, gainsaying, means quite simply the presumptuous rebellion. Here was a rebellion based on such tremendous, stupendous presumption that it has to be called the gainsaying of Korah. And as I say, what we are about to address our attention to this evening is no light thing. It is a major incident. It is the presumptuous rebellion of Korah. I want you to notice, please, that on this occasion, we learn that there were three times when Moses fell upon his face. He did so in verse number 4, he did so in verse number 22, and he did so in verse number 45. And we will see that that was the attitude of Moses when faced with this rebellion. He was cast upon his God and faced with the presumptuous upstart of this rebellion. He was cast entirely upon his God. When Moses heard it, he fell upon his face. And that act of falling upon his face, prostrating himself before God, was a symbol of his utter dependence upon God to meet the challenge of Korah. Moses here must rely on the resources of heaven if he has to meet the challenge that is presented by Korah. Now, I want you to notice, and let us just ask, why was this such a vital issue? And so much of this section is occupied with it. Why was it such a vital issue? I want to you to understand that the issue was as core and as basic as this. The devil had sought to prevent them entering the land. He had sought that. The refusal to go into the land was another attempt to keep the people enjoying Canaan. We saw that he'd prepared his forces in Canaan before the children of Israel ever left Egypt. He was ready. He was prepared for them. But he sought to stop them leaving Egypt. If he can't stop that, he sought to stop them at the Red Sea. If he couldn't do that, he sought to keep them back before Amalek. And then he sought to destroy their communion with God. And he sought to bring them to rebellion so that God might disown them. But little did he know the God with whom he was dealing. So the whole bent had to be to keep them out of the land. But this is more subtle. The whole point and issue in the rebellion of Korah was not to keep them out of the land, but to keep them out of the sanctuary. This was the point and issue. It was not to keep them out of Canaan. It was to keep them out of the sanctuary. It was to keep them from approaching the sanctuary. It was to ensure that the means of the approach to the sanctuary were destroyed. I tell you, the devil will try to keep you out of the sanctuary. He will seek to so order things that you cannot come boldly to the throne of grace to obtain that mercy that we so need in times of need. I tell you, this was the whole point at issue behind the rebellion of Korah. The tabernacle had been raised, the altar fires were ablaze, the Shekinah glory was overshadowing it and the camp, and the priestly function was being carried out, and the men of the place were bringing their offerings before God, and every day there was being taken outside of the camp the ashes of yesterday's burnt offering. And it was something that was a distress to the heart of the adversary. He wished to keep them away from the sanctuary. Can I tell you tonight? Let me repeat it. He wants to keep you away from the presence of God. He wants to keep you away. If he cannot hold you in his grip as an unsaved individual, he will seek to make you a saint who is a foreigner in the sanctuary. I tell you, it's grand, isn't it? When you hear the prayers and the gatherings of the saints of brethren, and the very attitude of the brethren in prayer shows that when they tread the courts of the sanctuary, they're on familiar ground. They know what it is to be in the sanctuary. They're treading courts that they tread often. They are familiar, and I don't use that in the bad sense. I use it in the good sense. They're familiar with the presence of God. Their deportment, their respect for all that is involved in that, and just the very language of their lips shows that they are familiar ground when they tread holy courts. Now this is the whole point in the rebellion of Korah. I want you to notice, therefore, that what we are having is a movement by Satan to strike at the very foundation of approaching God. If he cannot keep you in Egypt, he'll keep you out of God's presence. He'll rob God of your worship. He'll rob God of your devotion. He will rob God of your intercession. He will rob God of the joy that God receives from submissive saints who love his presence. I tell you, that's what he'll try and do. And make you a prayerless, worshipless, powerless Christian. That's what he wants to do. I wonder if I'm speaking to somebody tonight, and you say, well, that's the way I'm going. Prayerless, worshipless, aye, and devotionless as well, and powerless. You see, he knew that a people who did not approach the sanctuary could never enter Canaan. Why could they never enter Canaan? Because it required the ark to go before them to open the waters of Jordan. And I tell you, if there had been no priesthood and no approach, I tell you, it would not have been possible to possess Canaan. And so, let us keep that in mind. There are 3 days mentioned in this rebellion. The first 17 verses, there is a day of insurrection. From verse number 18 to verse number 40, there is a day of retribution. From verse number 41 to verse number 50, there's a day of mediation. And I dare say I could even add another one. If I'm to dip into chapter number 17, I will see that there's a day of confirmation. And so you can almost add it up to four if you so wish. I was thinking of chapter 16, a day of insurrection, a day of retribution, and then a day of mediation. And the matter was the priesthood. Now, let us just look, please, at the characters in this rebellion. And then we will look, perhaps, at the cause. But look at the characters. First of all, there is a Kohathite. Korah, the son of Isar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, a Levite of the family of Kohath. Now, you know, don't you? And if you've forgotten, do a little homework. You know how privileged the Kohathites were. They were privileged. But here is a man, and I dare say, the Kohathites who carried the... I've almost given it away. You've done your homework. They carried the holy vessels, yes. They carried the ark, they carried the altars, they carried the holy vessels. You might think that that was dignity indeed. You might think that that was something to be prized. But I'm going to show you tonight that this man, Korah, was a man who despised his calling. Now please, we will see that tonight. He despised his calling because there was something else on which his desire was set. So here is a man who despises his calling. Can I suggest for a moment that sometimes it's possible for us to do that? The gift that the Lord has given us, we reckon, is not good enough. No, we would rather be somebody else. You know, it may well be that you want to be a preacher and, you know, you reckon that you're the best gospel preacher in the north of America. And the trouble is nobody's spiritual enough to recognize that. Nobody recognizes gifts. And you know fine well that you sway them and they all pretend they're asleep. You know, just as an act of pretense to do you down. They're all jealous of you. Well, I've come across folks like that, you know. But this man despised his calling. And it may well be that you say, well, I know that this is what folks say that God's gift is for me, but I tell you, I could do better than this. Listen, there was a man. No matter how great was the dignity of his calling, no matter how precious was the things that were committed into his hand, here was a Levite who despised his calling. And in assemblies you can get that. Folks who would be somebody else. So they decide they're going to be a preacher, not they get. And the minute they start, you hear somebody who's been in the glory for 20 years. And if you look carefully, you see somebody who's been in the glory for 20 years. The mannerisms are all his, the voice is all his, you know. Trying to be somebody they're not. No, this man despised his calling. And that's a serious thing. I want you to notice that with them there was Dathan and Abiram. And these were sons of Reuben. These were Reubenites. Now I take it to be that if Kohath was a man who despised his calling, I dare say these men were bitter about their family history. They were bitter about the fact that Reuben did not get what they saw as his right. He did not get the birthright. He was the oldest son, but you know in Genesis 49 what he was. Unstable as water, thou shalt not prevail. Thou art my firstborn. And I tell you, Reuben would stand here and then found that the birthright was not to pass to him. Here are men who somehow or other are bitter about their family history. They feel that they have lost out. Now there are saints in assembly fellowship like that. Despising their calling. They think God's made a mistake. The gift that they have isn't what they really think they should be doing. There are also those who carry with them the baggage of past problems and the baggage of past failure. And this we see in these sons of Reuben. They're carrying the baggage of past generations. But sad to say, some folks still do that. But some folks still carry the baggage of maybe a generation just back, or maybe even baggage in their own lives. And by baggage I mean needless burdens that they carry about with themselves. I tell you, life is too short. It's your life. It's your years. And use them for God. And do not limit yourself by the baggage of history. And do not limit yourself by a feeling that the gift that God has given you is perhaps a little less than you would have liked. And so, we see these problems. Now, what's the difference between them? The difference between them is this, that Kohath is bold, but Dathan and Abiram, they were bold at a distance. There's a lot of folk like that. A lot of people like that. Korah was bold. He was the front man. And the others are trailing along behind. They're bold at a distance. But Korah was bold, brazenly face to face. Now you get that in presumptuous rebellion. There is some leader and there are others that are bold, provided there's a man who's prepared to go out in the front. And that's exactly what you find here. Now these were the characters. There's one called On who seems to have had some sense and seems to have come away from the thing before it just got to as dark, as serious as it was. On's never mentioned again. He seems to have had a bit of wakened up to the ugliness of what they were doing. Now that's the characters. What was the cause? What was the cause? You say, well, that was cause enough. No. I want you to notice, perhaps, this. You see, that was in their mind. But do you notice what they do? In verse number 3, do you notice what Korah does? Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy. Ha! You know what he says. He says, I'm standing here on the ground of holy zeal. You men are taking too much upon yourself. All the other people are holy as well. They can do exactly as much as you can do. All the other people are holy as well. And he was saying to the other folk, you know, these people, they're monopolizing the priesthood, and you folks are every bit as good. That was a terrible thing. That's actually what they were doing. They claimed holy zeal. We see that first of all. They claimed equality of function. They claimed that everybody should be on the same ground. They claimed equality of function. They claimed holiness of zeal. Now you see, you can get that in an assembly. You can get folks who say, well, there's these people, you know, and they're doing everything. They're doing all the important bits. And you know, they're doing, but you know, we're every bit as good. We're every bit as good. Sometimes that can be in the mind of the young. I know it's not here. But do you see the problem? They're claiming equality of function in the assembly of Israel, just as folks today would claim equality of function and place in the assembly. And such equality should never be. My dentist meets with a group who used to be in assembly, no longer so. And one day, when he was in the middle of my mouth, was as open as the cave of Adullam, and he was boring into it, he said to me, what do you think I should do tonight? We're going to elect our elders for the next year. Well, the noises that came out of my mouth, which were inarticulate, were enough to indicate to them that I wasn't as happy as I had been 5 minutes before, and the cause was not his drill. You know, you see, the cause. I had time to have a little chat with him for a minute after it. You see, he said democracy was a great... You see, we're democratic. I said, that's the problem. That's the problem. Democracy... Oh, no, I've come to North America. Oh. Sufficient to say that you know that government of the people, by the people, or for the people, if I got it right, is perhaps in... Well, let's just say it. It's not divine government. That is never the way that God governs. No, theocracy is the divine way. And this really was a kind of democracy. We're all fit, and we're all, there's equality of function. And you know this, I'm doing it out of holy zeal. I'm doing it because I want holiness to stamp this whole thing. Now, I want you to notice, please, two things, therefore, came out of that. First of all, the teaching was very seductive. Oh, it was very seductive. It was very fleshly attractive. You know, saying to the people, you know, you've got to rely on Moses, and you've got to rely on all this. You know, but Aaron there, there he is, and you know, they're getting to be on, these men. I tell you, they're about 100 years of age. They're getting on. And you see, you're relying on them. No, it was a very seductive teaching, and I want you to notice that behind it, it was a very self-exalting teaching. I want us to understand that. What actually was in the mind of this man? Was it that the whole of Israel should be priests? After all, they could look back and say, well, do you know, was that not God's original intention? A kingdom of priests. You see, scripture could be warped and turned. Well, later on, you know, Moses puts his finger on it when he says to the rebels, seek ye the priesthood also. Seek ye the priesthood also. Ah. Is it not a small thing that God has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself? He says to these Levites. And to do the service of the tabernacle. Is that not enough? But you seek the priesthood also. This was it. He was not seeking the priesthood for the whole of Israel. He was seeking the priesthood for himself. And he was seeking the priesthood for his family. He was seeking to usurp the office of Aaron and put himself and his family in that place. I tell you, when folks sometimes raise the banner of insurrection and claim they have the good of all the saints in mind, generally speaking, when all the saints, they've got that in mind, they have in mind that they should be front rank. They're really seeking place for themselves. So what you have in number 16 is place-seeking rebels. That's what you have. Place-seeking rebels who, if they had succeeded, would have ended priestly work in Israel. That really was what was in their mind. The damage, little interested them. The consequences never crossed their mind. They wanted the place. They wanted the position. They wanted what they saw as the power. And that is why number 16 is such a vital event in the wilderness journey. Of course, if you look, there was something else. And I think this is a very, very telling thing. If you look down, you will find this. That from verse number 12, the complaint to Moses is, thou hast not brought us into a land that floweth with milk and honey. You've not brought us in. Now they knew it was the people who kept them out, not Moses. But they say, you haven't brought us in. In other words, they blame the leaders for their own failure. Now that's a dreadful thing to do. They had failed. They blamed the leaders for their own failure. So let's summarize what they're doing. Power-seeking placemen. Blaming the leaders for their own failure. Moving under a seductive cloud with alluring, seductive words. We're all holy. We all should be having an even part in this. And beneath it all, there was the devil who was seeking to close the sanctuary to the children of Israel. Now keep that in mind. And so, that was the insurrection. I want you to notice, please, what happens in day number two. Now day number two starts, and we learn from, this is from about verse number 18, it doesn't say it in that verse, but this was day number two. And they took every man his censer and put fire on them, etc. This is the morrow. Verse number 18 is the morrow of 15 and 16. You see, it says in 15 and 16, thou and they and Aaron tomorrow, and now verse number 18 is tomorrow. So this is day number two. And every man's to take his censer. And what was a censer? It was a priestly thing. And so you see, they're taking. And Korah gathered all the congregation unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord appeared. This was a very telling thing. The glory of the Lord appeared. They had seen this before. verse 10 of chapter 14, all the congregation bade stone them with stones, and the glory of the Lord appeared. They see that the Lord is interested. Now I'm just going to pause. You say, what's this got to do with me in Detroit today? And start going. What's it got to do with you in Scotland? Can I say this? That it's possible in all of our hearts for a mood of discontent to grip us. An assembly is a unique thing on earth. There is nowhere else on earth with people with such different backgrounds, different employment, different characters, different abilities, different family circumstances, come together so often and so closely to work together in such close harmony as in a local assembly. There's nothing else on earth. Nothing like it. You say, well, there's folks of that, they go to golf clubs and they go to church. No, the assembly's not a congregation. It's not just something you turn up to in a Lord's Day on a Monday night or a Tuesday night or whenever. No, the assembly is something different. And do you know, one of the reasons for that is that the assembly is, amongst other things, is a place where we are molded. And part of the molding is having to live with each other. That's part of the molding. That's part of the changing. That's why it's so ordained. That this might be part of the mold that will make us what God wants us to be. And in that process, it's possible for us to become discontented. It's possible, aye, for us to become jealous. It's possible for the green eye to grip us when we see somebody perhaps making progress that we think is a little beyond where we've gone. And jealousy and discontent can bubble away in our souls and in our hearts. And this was behind the rebellion of Korah. Now notice what happens in day two. I've got to hurry. Notice what happens in day two, please. Day two, they gather before the Lord, Moses and Aaron, with the 250 men who had swallowed this, these leaders, these princes of the congregation. They gather before the Lord because they must learn this, first of all, that it is the Lord who will judge this issue. Now look, in the local assembly, when matters are there and there's a bit of discontent in my heart, I have got to learn that it is the Lord who will judge the issue, not me. It's the Lord who will determine. Oh, I know in an assembly, I know it doesn't happen in Stark Road, but it can be that some folk irritate you. Oh, they irritate you. As a matter of fact, they irritate you when they speak, they irritate you when they pray, they irritate you if they minister, and they even irritate you if they breathe. You know. They just irritate you. You see. But you see, that really is a test in the hands of God. The Lord will judge the issue. And so they come before the congregation and the Lord. Now, there is a test, isn't there, that's given here. And here is the test. You look at it. The Lord spake, speak, get you from about the tabernacle of Korah and Dan. In other words, the people are told to move away. Leave them on their own. They're going to be subject to the judgment of God. Leave it on their own. And you know what happened? The Word of God tells us quite clearly, and we read it, that the ground clave asunder, and these rebels fell down into the ground. If you look very carefully, you will see that Dathan and Abiram, if you look, turn to chapter 26, it is, Dathan and Abiram went down with Korah, down into the ground. I tell you, it is as if God was saying, such a thing as this must be buried. Now, my brethren and sisters, I say this seriously. If there are such thoughts in our heart, let us bury them before we are buried because of them. Now, what do I mean by you've been buried? I don't mean that physically, understand that. I mean been buried as far as usefulness for God is concerned. Sometimes these things eat away at the soul of an individual until he or she is buried by the fire and useless in the service of God. You bury them before they bury you. You bury them before God in discipline said you cannot function with a spirit and a heart and a bitterness like that. Bitterness, jealousy, and all that kind of thing. Bury it before it leads to you being buried as far as God's service is concerned. And that's what happened to these men. Listen, they gained nothing and lost everything. Now notice that. They lost their privileges. They lost their place. They lost their work. They lost the reward for that work. They allowed this burning jealousy in their heart to cost them everything and give them nothing. That's always the devil's work. He ends up, it always ends up, that we lose. And he knows we're moving into a thing that we will lose. And so there was judgment. I want you to notice that. The plates that were made from the censers of these men were put in the front of the altar, a constant reminder of the sanctity of the priesthood, that God will not tolerate it being touched. Now listen, every single believer is a priest. That doesn't mean you say every single believer can speak publicly in the assembly. I don't need to teach you that, you know that. But we all have priestly function. And it's up to us to exercise it and to enjoy it in the presence of God. But notice, would you think that anything good could come out of a family like that? What a background. To say, well actually, I'm descended from Korah. Could any good possibly come out of a family like that? Surely those who follow... Ah, but wait a minute, there's something you've got to learn. I read in Numbers chapter 26 that the sons of Korah were preserved and did not die. Is that not a remarkable fact? The sons of Korah were preserved and they did not die. Chapter 26, verse 11, notwithstanding, the children of Korah died not. Okay, they were survived. They survived. But could anything good ever come out of Korah? Could anything of any value come out of a family stained by one of the worst presumptuous rebellions in the history of Israel? Perished in the gainsaying of Korah hundreds of years later. Aye, thousands of years later. Almost. It was still in the lips of people, the gainsaying of... Could anything good come out of a family like that? Sometimes we turn to the first book of Chronicles and we're horrified at the names and the lists. Young believer, plow your way through them. There's hidden gold. But I tell you, it shines brightly when you find it. There's hidden gold in these lists. Sons of Korah. Samuel was a son of Korah. You say, no, you got that wrong. You've come all the way from Scotland and you don't even know 1 Samuel 1. You've got that wrong. You see, it says in 1 Samuel 1 that he didn't have that background at all. As a matter of fact, I'll read it to you and tell you what it says. It says that there was a certain man and he was an Ephrathite. He was of the tribe of Ephraim. Oh, I'll say, dear me, you haven't read 1 Chronicles. And you don't understand this, that he was only called an Ephrathite because he lived in that part of the country. 1 Chronicles tells me that actually Samuel was a son of Korah. Now you'll find that in chapter 6. If you read the section from verse 33 to verse 38, you'll come back tomorrow night and say you're quite right. Now the name's spelt slightly differently, but any good margin will tell you that the addition of 1 letter to it of that doesn't change it, it's still Samuel. And so, there we have it. Samuel came. Now you say, well, that's good. That's grand that a man like Samuel. You know, that's an encouragement to me. Listen. The fact that you have a good Christian assembly background does not guarantee that you will be somebody for God. Nor does it prevent you being somebody from God. But listen, the fact that maybe you've no background at all, or even a disreputable background, doesn't prevent you being something for God. Samuel, he was a son of Korah. Now, isn't it remarkable? If I was to go a little down further into that book, I would come across a man, and you know what his name was? He-Man. He-Man was a grandson of Samuel. Therefore, he was a son of Korah. Now you say, well, what did he do? Oh dear me, what did he not do? What did he do? Can I tell you what he did? He was a singer appointed by David to the temporary tabernacle that was raised, you know, at that time. And then I want you to notice, he prophesied with harps, with psalteries, with cymbals. He was David's seer. You say, well, that's pretty good going. He had 14 sons who were all appointed singers in the service of God. Oh, you say, well, that's good. All of these sons sang when in a later day the ark entered the temple. They were there. Do you know, in 1 Kings chapter number 4, He-Man was known as a wise man in the days of Solomon. Now, to be a wise man in the days of Solomon, you had to be a wise man. You know. I mean, sometimes there are societies when, pretty well, if you can tell the time, they regard you as an intellectual giant nowadays, you know. If you can do it without the use of a computer, that is. You know. But he was a wise man in the days of Solomon. He-Man. Oh, dear me. Do you know this? He wrote Psalm 88. And do you know this? That's a psalm out of trouble. And I tell you, all the sweeter because it came. Do you know that later descendants of the sons of Korah helped Hezekiah clean out the temple? And later sons sang at Josiah's great Passover. What does that tell me? It tells me firstly about the beauty of the grace of God. The grace of God. Listen, I've been speaking this week about a bountiful God. I want to tell you, there's nothing more bountiful than God's grace. God's absolute grace. I tell you, we are every single one of us here through grace alone. And this was what happened to these men. The sons of Korah, I tell you, you can hardly grasp it. And out of this disaster, there came something for God. You know, you might say, well, why did God work that way? Well, can I tell you why God worked that way? I'll tell you quite simply why God worked that way. Just with the same reasoning as we saw in the selection of the tribe of Levi for priests. I noted on that occasion that Levi and Simeon were linked together in such a way as murderers that you would have thought that nothing could be made of them. Well, listen. God's grace is seen in priests being appointed. God's grace is seen in the preservation of the sons of Korah. And it's simply because none of them could ever say, I am what I am because I deserve to be. Every single one of them would need to say, I am what I am despite myself, not because of myself. And I tell you, in the service of God, you are what you are, and I am what I am, despite myself, not because of myself. And we learn that beautiful thing from the sons of Korah. Now, there's confirmation in chapter 17. The third day, by the way, starts in verse 41. It's remarkable in verse 41 that the people, I just want you to notice this, in verse 41, the people then murmur against Moses, and what do they say? They say, you've killed the people of the Lord. You respond, you've killed the people of the Lord, Moses. There's dead people, and you killed them. Is that any way it worked for God? I tell you. And God sends a plague. Now, who preserves them from the ravages of the plague? Aaron, the high priest. The priest whom they despised is now working on their behalf. I tell you, that's another evidence of the grace of God. Do you know what I'm going to tell you? We have a great high priest who works on our behalf, despite the fact that we are often unfaithful to him. And here are an unfaithful people, a people into whom the plague has come, and it's Aaron. He stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stayed. I tell you, it's a grand thing in the Bible to look at. There's not many of them, occasions when the plague was stayed. The plague was stayed by the work of the priest whom they sought to dismiss. I like that. We're seeing more and more the grace of God in it. The grace of God in the family of Korah, and the grace of God in the people who still complained. The confirmation was given that the Aaronic priesthood was the priesthood. Do you know, Aaron's rod was put in the sanctuary with the rods of all the others. And in the morning, God gave his verdict. Aaron's rod budded. Confirmation that Aaron was the rightful high priest of Israel. I tell you, and I speak, I trust reverently, we have a great high priest. Do you know that our eternal glory is dependent on the fact that he will always live? He liveth forevermore. As long as he is alive, we are safe. As long as he is alive, we are safe. And praise God. I don't have time to go into the death of a high priest tonight and the cities of refuge, but as long as he is alive, we are safe. And he liveth forevermore. And his rod constantly will bud. There'll always be a fruitfulness about him. Always a harvest freshness about him. His rod will always bud and never wither. Now, there's confirmation. I'm going to take 5 minutes, because we must do. And I'm just going to lay the foundation for what I'm going to talk about tomorrow night. You don't need to turn to it, but the journey to Canaan started at the beginning of chapter 20. It started in the first month of the 40th year after they left Egypt. We don't know the day. It just says that they came into the desert of Zin in the first month, and the people abode in Kadesh. So there they are. Do you notice the whole congregation came in? There was no stragglers lost. Those who died, of course, did die under discipline, but no stragglers lost. The whole congregation came in the first month. They commenced the journey on the first month. They came to Mount Hor on the first month of the first day of the fifth month, and Moses addressed Israel on the banks of the Jordan on the first day of the 11th month of that 40th year. So what we're about to speak about is really the last year of the wilderness journey. And on the first day, the first month of the 40th year, they came in. Now, I'm only going to mention it for this reason, that before they left, there was another rebellion. And it was the same as the problem 40 years before. There was no water. Now, I've dealt with this, but you'll see I'm going to deal with it again for a specific reason. There was no water. And Moses was told, take the rod, and this time it's Aaron's rod, and gather thou the assembly together, and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock, so thou shalt give the congregation and their beasts drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Lord, as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said unto them, now listen to this, hear now ye rebels. must we fetch you water out of this rock? The meekest man on all the earth has broken. Now listen, he was the meekest man in all the earth at that time, but there was one who came who was even meeker, who never broke under strain. This man at last broke under strain. You're going to say, you don't blame him, do you? I'm not blaming him. I'm simply saying there was a man who never did break under strain, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. Now listen. And Moses lifted up his hand and he smote the rock twice. In Deuteronomy 1, we learn the Lord was angry. He was angry. But listen, I mentioned last week the differences. A different rod, a different generation, a different command. But there was one difference I left out. Now this is most remarkable. In the Exodus account, just after they left Egypt. Now, when you get two accounts of something in Scripture, one of the reasons is that you might weave and tease out the differences between the two accounts. That's what's so good about the book of Deuteronomy. Tease out the differences. There are lessons. Now, the difference is this. You might just read it over and say, it's inconsequential. It's not. It's very consequential. Listen to what it says. And Moses lifted up his hand, and with the rod he smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beasts also. You say, well, so what? So what? In the Exodus account, it does not tell us that the water came out. Now the water did come out. The psalmist tells us that the water came out. But in the Exodus account, it doesn't actually say. I'm sure some of you are flicking over your Bibles. I can assure you it doesn't. But check it out. Oh, please check it. It doesn't actually say the water came out. Here it says that the water came out abundantly. Why? Two reasons I see. First reason is this. To show that the disobedience of Moses did not cause the people to suffer. In the grace of God, the water still came out. That's one lesson. But the lesson I want to really drive home is this. Sometimes if God blesses us, we are inclined to think it's because of our obedience. Read Numbers 20 and rid that thought out of your head. It states that the water came out to show that despite disobedience, God still blessed. And sometimes you get people who say, well, you see, we go to a place and there's hundreds come and there's every week folk are getting saved and all that kind of thing. And young believers sometimes say, what do we do with a thing like that? I say, well, it's quite simple what you do with a thing like that. What is that to thee? Follow thou me. You just leave that to the Lord. Just leave that to the Lord. Follow thou me. Remember that to obey is better than sacrifice and to hearken than the fat of rams. But nevertheless, just you leave that to the Lord. But listen, learn the principle that God's hand in blessing is no guarantee that the people are as submissive to Scripture as they should be. That's why it's specifically mentioned here. A very vital lesson. That you cannot equate blessing with submission. And you cannot say that the most godly are the most outwardly blessed in their service. You can't say that. Samuel Rutherford, up there, well, no, not up there, here. across that way, whatever it was. Samuel Rutherford in Anworth, for years preached the gospel, saw nobody say, are you going to tell me that was because of the man's disobedience? Do not equate the hand of God in blessing with reward for obedience. Here, they disobeyed. The people didn't deserve it. Oh, the people didn't deserve it. But in Exodus, you can see, well, the grace of God through Moses. Moses surely deserved it. Here, when you come to Numbers 20, he didn't deserve it either. blessing is no barometer of godliness. You say, well, why is that? For the very simple reason that God is absolutely sovereign. He will bless where he will bless. And you say, well, the diminishing numbers not teach us lessons and all that kind of thing. I don't deny that. I don't go after that. I don't want you to leave tonight saying it doesn't matter. But what I don't want you to think is this, that because perhaps there are those who seem to be getting more blessing than you would want, or that you imagine you could possibly have wherever you are, just remember this. Blessing is no cause for you to sacrifice truth in order to go in for it. And here we have it stated, the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank. Personally with Moses and Aaron, the Lord spoke. That's another issue. This is the water of Meribah. Personally, because ye believe me not to sanctify, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation. Yes, Moses suffered because of it, because of his disobedience. But the water still came out. We've seen today the absolute grace of God. The grace of God over the rebellion of Korah. The grace of God in the use of the sons of Korah. The grace of God in continuing to give water, even when there was disobedience. And God willing, tomorrow evening, we will follow them in their journey as they turn south and then later north and head towards the Jordan.